Welcome to the Movie Vault. I'm
Good
Ben.
Good morning, Ben. I'm Zach.
And this is our second straight episode that we're recording.
Before 9 a.m.
It's a whiplash for the viewer because we're going to release this episode first, even though it's recorded second. I don't know. I said the viewer. We have no recording.
Well, if they're viewing us, that's a little creepy.
You're viewing us with sound waves. Through the sound waves.
You're viewing us through your ears.
You're seeing the picture of us on your phone.
Or you're picturing us in your mind.
Yeah. I was thinking it'd be cool. Oh, I guess we have a picture of us on the cover of our podcast, but I wonder what people would imagine us looking like if they didn't know what we look like. They just heard our voices.
They'd probably think I look like Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, and I'd probably be like a really buff, fit guy.
Yeah, maybe.
No, I'm just kidding. I have no idea. It is interesting to think about like what people associate your voice with. But
they would both think that we're white.
They would think that. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that's guaranteed.
Mm-hmm. Today we're going to review Les Samouraïs, a 1967 neo-noir crime thriller film. Why are we doing this? Well, this is the third film in our little series arc of 1960s films. This will cap it off pretty well, hopefully. We started with French in Eyes Without a Face. We went to Italian with 8.5, and we are finishing with French again. We didn't plan it that well, so.
It's more of like, Euro art house 1960s film.
It's a loose structure.
Or like major works of the 1960s in Europe. They're not even art house. These are fairly well-known movies at this point.
This is not an art house film whatsoever.
No.
It's written and directed by Jean-Pierre Melville. I'm just going to pronounce it however I want. Starring Alain Delon and François Perrier, Nathalie Delon as well, and Kathy Rozier.
Yeah, if you just try to not pronounce it well, that's probably how it's actually pronounced.
It's actually a Franco-Italian production.
Oh, interesting. So we're still getting the Italian reference.
Oh, so we're going to, we'll go with that. And it's about a hitman basically trying to find out who hired him for this job and who was trying to get him killed. And just the government's trying to get him as well, the police, because he killed someone. So it's kind of just like a crime thriller. It's fun. It's pretty clean. It's talking about there aren't really many inappropriate scenes.
People getting killed. That's
I think it's
it.
PG, in fact.
Yeah.
This might be the first PG film besides Trolls that we've ever done.
That's true. Or at Pixar movies. Done some Pixar movies.
Oh, yeah. Soul.
Yeah.
Or the other ones.
Yeah. So if you're trying to get your kids into crime thrillers, this might be a good one.
Yeah. With subtitles. And the hitman is Jeff Costello. And he is kind of this guy who lives on his own. He's by himself. He's got this bird in his apartment, which actually turns out to be like a security system.
Right.
But he is hired for this job to kill this guy named Marty, who owns Marty's, which is a nightclub. And he is, seen by some people there. And then he eventually gets caught, and they are questioning these people. And the person, this one lady who works there, who plays the piano and sings there at the nightclub, saw him vividly, like very up close. I don't know why I use the word vividly. It's not like the most fitting.
No, it kind of is. She like should vividly remember him.
Yeah, she would. Yeah, that's a better way. And she denies that it was him. So then he's like, okay, why did you do that? He asks her. He approaches her later on in the film. And I'm four sentences into the synopsis that I just made up in my head. And this is already two-thirds of the movie. So there's not really much talking.
No.
But
we can talk about that, yeah.
She ends up apparently working for the people who hired him. And he kind of figures that out, like, oh, why don't you want me to get caught? So, if he gets caught, that's a liability for those who hired him. And if he, whatever. So she denied seeing him. And then he eventually is bugged in his apartment, but his bird kind of has some different mannerisms, or squawks a little differently or chirps a little differently. And he notices. So he finds that. It's really like a down-to-earth kind of, like, every scene is like a very personal scene. So it's not like there are these big plot points. It's kind of like following this one specific guy, Jeff. So then anyway, Yeah, he gets home. He is ambushed by the man who did shoot him, and because he gets shot earlier, I skipped that part. He gets shot, and then he has to. Yes, he goes to he ends up getting that man who shot him, and kind of overpowering him, and then he has to that man that he overpowers, tells him the identity of the boss, Oliver Ray, and. Yeah, that's pretty much the film. The end of it is kind of fun, too. There are, like, some gun scenes, some cool fight scenes as well. Not really fight scenes. Shootout scenes is a better way to say it. And Jeff gets shot a bunch of times at the end by the police officers.
Mm-hmm. A very startling ending, I would say.
Yeah. And apparently when he... So Jeff goes back into the same nightclub where... He originally killed Marty.
Which is like the second time that he does yeah. this. Like
and he goes points back to a gun at the girl who saw him vividly. Mm-hmm. And apparently he didn't have any guns in the bullet or bullets in the gun. And they shoot him. So it was, I'm still kind of wrapping my head around, you know, what is happening in this film. It's very straightforward. You can understand what's physically happening. But like what's going through Jeff's head as he's going back to the nightclub. Yeah,
you're seeing... the actions of the people, but it doesn't really immerse you in their thoughts because none of the characters talk that much, especially Jeff, who we spend the most time with.
Mm-hmm.
He's very mysterious. We don't really know his motive. At the beginning, we don't even know what he's doing.
Yeah.
The first thing we see him do is steal a car, which was apparently incredibly easy in France at that time. You just had to have a key.
Which like he had all the keys to the city, apparently.
To like every car in Paris, and you just got to go through and try them all. And hope that it's not all the way at the end.
And you can just walk right in. They don't lock cars. Yeah, I thought I'd give a little short synopsis since this story is absolutely so straightforward. But yeah, the main actor, Alain Delon, actually does a great job, I think.
Yeah.
He's like he plays this very serious younger guy. But you can kind of see in his expressions like, he's serious, but also like, and he's like a good agent. He's good at what he does. He's a good hitman, but he does get caught. So like there are some flaws in him as well. So you can kind of see like he's stressed out throughout this whole film, but he kind of holds it in. So there's like there's two layers to his acting where one of them is he has a mission to carry out, but then you can also see underneath that, the struggles that he's experiencing without him expressing it or saying a single thing or confiding in anyone.
Yeah, he really, the only person he has to kind of confide things in and turns out to be fairly trustworthy as his girlfriend, or I don't even know if you consider her a girlfriend, but a lady friend of some kind who he has a relationship with, Jane, who does end up vouching, not giving information to the police, even though they are convinced they can sort of blackmail her into doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't. But really, he has outside of her, he has no one, and even she is probably not the most trustworthy person overall. So, and we don't know why he's become this hitman. At the beginning, he seems pretty satisfied to not really know what's going on and to just do his job, create an alibi, and hopefully skate by the police. But it's when that unforeseen moment of having the hit on him from the people who hired him that he realizes, okay, I need to figure out what's going on here. And then he starts to investigate, and then he's in the middle, and there's like two boulders rolling down the hill. One's the police and one's the people who hired him, and he's right in the middle having to try to fend off both.
Mm-hmm.
Which he might have been capable of fending off just one, but trying to you know, both be the pursuer and seeking kind of revenge or for the people who have like crossed him, who have hired him, and then, you know, warding off the police who are like putting out basically everyone to track him. Even though he has this alibi, they are like fairly convinced it's him because he fits the description. So, I mean, I was shocked when he came into the police station and he was just wearing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
It seems like he could have had a better plan of like changing his outfit or something. So.
You said that. You kept saying like, he's so stupid. Just change the outfit. Because that's like, how they were trying to recognize him.
Yeah. I don't know whether his plan was to get caught and to use the alibi. Like, But it seems like if you would have just, you know, changed it to something different, they would have, they may have, you know, been able to trace back to him still, but mm-hmm. it would have been a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's interesting because it seems like in the theme of you said boulders, he is stuck between a rock and a hard place. And people on both sides of this deal that was made are kind of betraying him, right? He's kind of being screwed over by his boss. He's being, or the guy who hired him, and he's being screwed over by the police, which makes sense because he tried to kill, or he killed someone. So as he tries to navigate who he can trust, it's an interesting noir film. You know, whenever I think of the noir film category, I tend to think of films that kind of get gritty or involve a lot of death or sex or, I don't know, just unclean films. It's cool. It was cool to see a film like this where all of that was excluded and it was kind of just strictly, you know,
business
mystery.
Yeah, business and mystery. Yeah, that is a good point. And I didn't venture off into those other areas. Kind of alluded to like some seedier things with, especially with Jane and her relationship with men, mm-hmm. and you know, all of that, but it didn't feel like it had to like overstay its welcome in terms of visiting those themes. Like, I always appreciate when films do that. They like acknowledge that there's things that go on that are like bad or questionable mm-hmm. morally. But they don't, you don't always have to like wallow in those things like some movies do. Some movies, it feels like their whole point is to just be like, wow, look at what these people are doing. It's like bad, or it's like morally questionable or illicit. But it, and of course, like the, I thought of this as like an anti-hero movie because this is a movie that centers around a hitman. Mm-hmm. So objectively, his job is like to kill people, which is not a good thing. Even if those people are bad, like,
what a great stance you have, Ben.
Yeah, I'm coming out. I'm taking a shocking stance here and saying that I don't agree with murder or, you know, doing murder for pay.
Yeah.
You know, you should go through the justice system, do arrests. I support. Well, I don't know whether I should say I support the police that has some like baggage with it, but I support the concept of justice. I don't necessarily unquestionably.
Keep going, Ben. Keep going.
Unquestionably,
what you're trying to say on the movie vault to the public.
Unquestionably, always support the police in every context, but in general, I support the concept of you know, having a, not having one person be the judge, jury, executioner, which Jeff is not even that because he doesn't know why he's killing this person. He's just hired to kill him. So for all he knows, he could just be an innocent nightclub owner.
Yeah.
I love the style of the movie, though. The soundtrack is really,
oh, incredible.
It stands out. It engages you with the movie. I love the beginning aspect, how it draws you in with its, I think, like, There's a long period where like almost no one talks, and if they talk, you don't really know what they're talking about. Like when he gets to the garage, I think, mm-hmm. to change the license plates on the car for the first time. That's the first time anyone talks, and you have no idea why he's doing it. So like, it presents mystery from the beginning because you don't even know who the character you're following mm-hmm. is. You have to figure that out, and then a mystery presents itself, and you have to try to figure that out. Mm-hmm. And then of course it's not exactly a mystery because you know the answers to the questions that some characters are asking, like the investigators. Mm-hmm. They don't know for sure that Jeff did it, but we as a viewer do know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it's not a mystery in the sense that like there's this big reveal.
Yeah.
But how it's all going to play out is a mystery to us, which I really like that.
Definitely. And I think that's to its advantage, just the kind of – it's focused on the style of the film. I liked even though his dress was annoying in the practical sense of like he should change so he doesn't get caught. But it reminded me of Inspector Gadget. Do you know who he
is? Yeah. Yes.
Just the fedora and the big trench coat and how he kept pulling things out of his trench coat throughout the film. And
mm-hmm.
so, I mean, all that was cool.
He seemed like a stereotype of a hitman.
Yeah.
Kind of character. I guess you would think of him more as like a private eye, but he's not that at all in this movie, other than when he investigates for himself. Like,
well, it's almost the reversal of the hitman trope where you hire someone like that to, and then in the movies they're portrayed as these people who are watching other people, but in this one he is the one that is watched. He is the one that is cornered in on by other people. So
he has a very like confident way he goes about his job. Like even in the scene where he kills the nightclub owner, he walks in. He's not trying to blend into the environment. He just goes in and does it and leaves very confidently.
With his face shown, making complete eye contact with everyone.
Which again goes back to, like, it feels like Jeff wants to get caught, but I don't know why. Because at the end of the movie, when he goes into the nightclub and eventually gets shot, you're like, has he given up on life at that point? Is that like, is he like committing suicide? But not, because he points a gun at this lady. It's not loaded. So it's very odd. And maybe, you know, we talk about how we love ambiguity. So I guess here we are with an ambiguous ending. I mean, it's very definite in the fact that Jeff dies, but it's ambiguous in the sense of like, we're questioning some of the decisions that he makes, especially for all the effort he goes through to escape the police throughout the entire movie. And then all of a sudden he's just like drawing the police to him.
Yeah, Costello's motives throughout the film are questionable. I always wonder, like, did he just give up in the end and just want to die?
Yeah.
He didn't bring bullets.
No, that's exactly what it seems like.
So, but it also seems like throughout the film he was trying to avoid death. So yeah. I didn't know if, like, throughout the trials of this film it led him to give up. But I didn't get that sense. I didn't see, like, a breaking point or a rock bottom moment.
He seems like someone who takes a lot of pride in his work and believes he's the best. And it's almost like his purpose in life has become being a hitman. Like, instead of it's more than just a job now. It's become like his everything about him. He has no other aspect to his life other than this. And like I said, in the middle of the movie, he goes back to the bar, and I think the guy like kind of recognizes him, but then somehow he ends up leaving. It's a very odd scene. So. Yeah, I don't, and then of course at the end he goes back to the bar and he visits the lady who plays the piano, and when he questions, you know, why she didn't kill him, and then eventually he goes back and has killed the person who hired him. So maybe he's lost all faith in you know, he can't trust anyone who's hiring him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The police are after him. He's always like, he's not gonna be able to work as a hitman in Paris anymore.
Yeah.
He'd have to like move to a different city.
Yeah.
So maybe he has just given up at the end. He's like, if I leave, I want to go out like a badass.
Yeah. I agree. And Valerie, you're kind of questioning her motives as well. She's the pianist. Just the idea that she does work at the nightclub where he was killed. So it's almost like they had eyes on Jeff the whole time and were planning like they had backup, but like they weren't just going to send Jeff in to kill Marty, right? They needed some insurance, per se, to where they purposefully placed her in the area where Jeff would be, to get a good the best look out of him, so that she would have the most trustworthy eyewitness when it came to questioning. And that is, I mean, it feels like he was always going to be set up, you know. So I do question even his boss's motives. Like, what's the point of setting him up for this?
I think in the brief meetings we get between the leaders of the whatever business conglomerate, shady establishment thing is going after Marty, it seems like him being arrested was a big deal to them.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like Jeff was completely prepared for this to happen. Like, it's almost like they had an expectation that when hiring him, he would not get arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And he had more of an understanding that he just needed to not, like, actually be, you know, found guilty of killing the person.
Yeah.
But even him just being found out who he was could eventually link back to them. So at that point, they were trying to stamp out all traces. And if Jeff dies, there's not going to be a manhunt for him. Which I guess Marty was like, mm-hmm. has a little bit more. They're doing a manhunt of the entire city, every quadrant, curfews, you know, anybody who had a gun and was dressed remotely like him. That wouldn't have happened if Jeff died.
It was also hilarious to just see, I don't know if this represented the French criminal justice system in the 60s, but just it was funny to see them all line up and see how they based it all on eyewitness accounts and how wrong they kept getting, like, no, it's not him. And the only
eyewitnesses are, it's supposed to be like a great way of proving who it was, but like they all disagree and there's so many like biases and like misrememberings and stuff that can influence what you perceive of a situation, especially something that happens so quickly.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, it's not a commentary on that type, those types of things, but
not really,
it plays into it a little bit. But yeah, I mean, what do you think was, what do you think worked for this film and what do you think didn't?
What worked, like I said, was just the pacing and the whole setting up the whole movie like a mystery, not just one aspect of the movie. And some people might find the pacing a little bit slow, but I think it overall worked. And then it kind of built to the point where there was more tense scenes, which I think makes the slow pace at the beginning pay off a lot more. The acting was great. And it was, you know, I think you can see why people would have considered this a unique direction style, because it is a noir film and there had been noir films for a long time. But think about the noir films that you like. The stereotype of noir films is like there's a guy narrating. Sunset Boulevard is an example of that. There's narration. And Sunset Boulevard is a great movie. It does it well, where it sets it up. The crime happening in the beginning and it goes back and tells you the whole picture of what happened, but without narration and just sort of the narration takes away from that like intrigue element to some degree, depending on how it's actually executed. And it's not as much this like, man, I'm a loner who's you know, a private eye and I'm going paycheck to paycheck, because this guy isn't a private eye. He's a hitman, which again goes back to the idea, like this was in Europe, they didn't follow the Hays Code, but in the US they did. And it keeps coming up in one of my classes, so I keep thinking about it, but they wouldn't have necessarily been able to set up this movie where the hitman is like the guy that you're rooting for.
Yeah.
Prior to the Hays Code being like people's like kind of discontinuing like following it and like going in a different direction.
Yeah. Wait, did that apply in France?
No.
Okay. Just
there's a Hollywood thing.
Okay.
So in France, as there could have been rules, but I don't think like censorship.
There are no rules in France. You know that.
Yeah.
It's a madhouse.
We're as strict.
I saw this theory online that I kind of agree with, where it's like you have three different things that are closing in on Jeff, right? His employer turns on him, and it's not his fault. He didn't do anything to deserve that. I mean, besides killing people indirectly.
Besides getting arrested. That's the...
Sure.
That's what they're arguing. But it looks like they're looking for an excuse to get rid of him.
Yeah, I mean, they planted her there to be an eyewitness, so they...
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
And I just lost my train of thought. Oh, the second thing that is closing in on him is obviously the police, who are trying to get him for killing someone. The third thing is his girlfriend, who is now with kind of, you know, like with someone else at that time, kind of betraying him as well. So his home life and... his work life and his legal citizenship life are closing in on him. And I saw this theory online and it was true. I mean, I noticed it in the film where it's like every single time Jeff's life gets more stressful or spirals, it like zooms in on his face a little bit more. So like he has close-up shots and they just get closer and closer. So from the at the beginning of the film, when he goes into the car, there are close-up shots. But as the film goes on, those shots get closer and closer. So it's like things are closing in on him, you know? It's like a metaphorical
thing. Yeah, that's so subconscious, but it's a great technique. Now that you mention it, I could like see it, but I definitely didn't notice that in the moment.
But at the end of the film, this is why the theory works for me. When he goes in the third time, to the nightclub, to Marty's, and he has the empty gun, he goes up to Valerie, and there are very close-up shots at that point. It's really like up to his face and it's really stressful. And he was, you know, those close-up shots are like things are closing in on him. He has no control of his life. But in that moment, after he is shot by the cops, it kind of shows the camera like kind of goes back out. It's like an aerial view. And it's like maybe the whole reason that he basically killed himself, unalived himself, whatever gets us more listeners.
Yeah.
So we don't get any... flags.
Self-censorship. We're back to the Hays Code.
Whatever. And that's him gaining control of his life. At least he had control of his death.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. That's a pretty good theory. Because that's what we're left with, because Jeff never really expresses himself. Mm-hmm. So, which is great. I think it's good to have movies where people express themselves. I think if you had all movies that were like this, you might get a little frustrated. But it is nice to have a movie that you're left trying to interpret somebody visually. Because, I mean, we hear it all the time when they talk about basic, like, human social things in medicine and mm-hmm. in psychology, how much nonverbal communication and, like, observing someone and their body language communicates about them. Sometimes people can misrepresent themselves with their nonverbal cues.
Yeah.
Like, they might be thinking differently than they're portraying. But most of the time, because we're not actively thinking about how we're portraying ourselves, you can notice when somebody looks stressed.
Mm-hmm.
And you can notice. And then, of course, it's not all just observing non-social cues. It's also, or non-verbal cues, I should say. It's also observing his actions. So
mm-hmm.
we see what he did at the end. So that obviously means something, because he made a deliberate decision to go in there, mm-hmm. not disguise himself and pull the gun out. So there was some meaning behind that. It's not like he just did that on an impulse. And knowing Jeff, he's very mm-hmm. calculated. So it's yeah. consistent with his character that if he does something, it's something that he's thought about for a little bit.
Yeah. What do you think his bird represented?
Is it maybe his vulnerability? The fact that the main thing protecting him is these little birds that are, like, so weak?
Maybe, yeah. So, or his, like, loneliness?
His loneliness, too. Like, there's his company.
Yeah. Because, I mean, he's presented as this samurai, right? This pure samurai with Which no emotional really attachments.
Interesting way to describe him, the samurai. Because we usually think of samurai as, like, very noble. We've talked about this on some of our Japanese cinema episodes, but then later on they became sort of more for hire, like mm-hmm. he is.
Yeah.
So it's like the evolution of what the samurai were.
Yeah.
As a warrior class to.
Well,
like,
they had the Bushido code, right?
Right.
So they had to kind of follow the strict rules of the samurai, and he's presented as the samurai in this film. Why? Because he's a lone wolf.
Yeah.
And I think that bird is kind of like his only attachment that he allows yeah. himself.
He's a killer for hire. Yeah, he doesn't have very many attachments. That's why the one aspect of closing in that I maybe don't agree with as much is I'm not sure that Jane being with the other guy really bothered him that much.
Maybe.
Because I don't know how serious he was about his relationship with Jane. Now, Jane says stuff like, you need me. I love that you... Like, she likes that this guy who's so closed off always comes back to her.
Mm-hmm.
But then to me, it's like they could still kind of be using each other.
Yeah.
Like, why does he need her? Is it a purely sexual thing? Is this like one sort of emotional outlet that he opens up with?
Hmm.
Like, could be a lot of things. We don't really know. And that's why I'm like not 100% convinced that he doesn't know that she's with this other guy or with other guys.
I think he developed feelings for Valerie, the pianist.
Yeah.
So I think maybe his rejection of Jane is in pursuit of Valerie, and when he goes in to try to gain control at the end of the film, again, it's just a theory that he's before Valerie, like he wants to be there because he goes specifically to her. He's there for her. If Valerie weren't at I don't think he's at Marty's because that's the place where the murder happened. I think he's there because Valerie's there,
right?
So I think he goes in and dies right in front of her, dying seeing the woman he loves. Maybe
that. There's no conclusive evidence for or against.
He also had a songbird.
True.
So he likes music. She played the piano.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there's something there as well.
Or maybe he's just also intrigued. I don't know. Once he gets the answer, I'm not sure I would be as intrigued. But just like why somebody would defend you like that. But then once you realize she's has a relationship with the guy who hired him to kill Marty, it's like, I don't know. I don't know whether that's as impressive that she stood up for him, because yeah. she might be more scared of Olivier Reyes than she is of the police.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, Jane is like, is her name Jane? I keep forgetting.
The pianist?
No, that's Valerie.
The girl's name is Jane.
Yes.
And then, yeah, Valerie.
And I mean, I think you're right, like in your comment earlier, she is like an alibi for him. So they're kind of using, he's at least using her. And it doesn't seem like she loves him.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like she loves it. It seems like she she likes that he's there. She like there's some aspect of him that she desires, but mm-hmm. it's not like a loving. It's not the most wholesome relationship ever. Yeah, it seem like.
Yeah,
and it seems like she. I know, the detective kind of tries to paint her as like basically a prostitute. But she's not like charging people. She's kind of like this, you know, the guy that she was with very well could have been married. He was older mm-hmm. and this is kind of like his mistress. And she's kind of set up this life where she's single, she's independent, but she also like allows all of these different guys in her life who knows exactly her motives of why she's doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely are kind of vulnerable as a woman if you do that, because you start getting involved with these men who are kind of dangerous and their motives for being with you. But maybe she's, you know, who knows what her past is, traumas that could make her sort of more intrigued by these like more dangerous individuals.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Another thing was, if he is a samurai, and we're going to take this literally to its most logical conclusion, I remember it, so that in the Bushido code, and I just looked it up even to confirm, there was this thing called seppuku, where if you kill your employer, which he did, you must kill yourself.
Mm.
I don't know if he follows that strictly, but it seems like, I mean, it's the title of the film, so it has to like there has to be some logic there with his supposed suicide at the end. And he kind of has this own code of honor that the samurai wouldn't even follow necessarily, the original samurai before they became hitmen almost. So he sees this moral code that he has created all the way to the end. He follows it through and commits seppuku. I forget if that's how you pronounce it. So yeah, I mean, he's gaining control of his life. He's committing seppuku. He is, yeah, I mean, he says he was paid to do it, right? So I mean, I think he's just trying to live as honest as he can, and living as honest as he can is death. It's not right, but that's what his moral code is. That's something that he set up and follows.
Yeah, I guess that does follow as a samurai. You think of samurai as they had this sort of like killing themselves in a context that is honoring.
Yeah.
Like, so, and that's something that people talk about with samurai. So it again fits with. And we say killing himself, like he didn't actively kill himself, but we're arguing that he set himself up to be killed, which is kind of the same as killing yourself.
Yeah.
If you know that that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, maybe he did. I mean, he had to know the police were following him, because like maybe he would have assumed that it was more like they would have called the police and they wouldn't have been already there, because that's why it's kind of shocking is. Like, you're like, you get so focused on him pulling the gun out, and then all of a sudden, boom, he's dead. You're like, what?
Mm-hmm.
And they were camped out there already.
Yeah.
So, but we it shouldn't be that surprising, because they were already following him all over the city.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I mean, these are just thoughts that are coming out, honestly. I didn't get these. Like, these, you know what I mean? Like, the way that we're interpreting the film now is just coming to me.
Yeah, because during the movie, you're so focused on just following what's happening. You're not necessarily thinking about the whys of, you know, and the picture doesn't even come fully together until the exact end.
Yeah.
So it is a movie that would lend itself to kind of, you start questioning it after you've sat on it for a little bit.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like he had this code he lived by, and he wanted to die by that code, and to gain control of his own life. Like, really, he was obsessed with control. Like, he lived by that code so he could be in control.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to die by any other hands than himself.
Yeah, and what really threw him off was when things started to go not according to plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to have some context as to what his other hit jobs were like, and if they went really smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it didn't seem like he was... Good. Seemed like he didn't have a record, right? So he's pretty under the radar.
Or that was his first job.
Yeah, and that would be interesting too. Yeah. What if that was his first job? Like, what if he sold himself to these people like he was an expert hitman and this was actually the first time? Like, let's just say he had, you know, done some like car thievery before and stuff like that, but nothing to this level.
Yeah. I mean, car thievery was so easy back then, it could be a hobby, you know? Yeah, I don't know. He went through the motions because it was his obligation. And he also didn't kill the pianist because I believe he was, it, the movie infers that he was at one point supposed to target her. But he refuses to, either because of love or because she saved his life. And that's the Bushido code, or both. I don't really know. But yeah, I think, you know, going off of my question earlier, what works and what doesn't, what works is the, I mean, it's not a, I don't know if it's a character arc, but it's like, honestly, it's Jeff. Jeff works. Jeff's great. What doesn't work for me, I'd say, is maybe some of, you said the pacing. For me, I think the pacing was a negative.
Really? Do you think it was too, like, disjointed?
Yeah, at the beginning, it felt a little off.
I don't know. I liked that.
It felt
maybe
too,
it's just it personal felt, opinion.
It felt inconsistent. Like, it was really fast in some parts. Isn't the first half of the film?
It is, it
fast,
definitely,
and then
yeah.
Some parts were really slow.
It's not a consistently paced movie. Yeah, I agree with that.
And it doesn't, you know, films don't have to be consistently paced. I just thought, I felt like, oh, I thought we were going to spend more time there. I don't know. I just felt awkward. I felt awkward to me in some parts. So I was surprised when you said that was a pro. But
yeah.
Maybe you like it. That's how it is. Maybe this is another good time situation.
Yeah, I think I like the pacing because, I don't know, it maybe just worked for me. I don't know whether I can
get cuz it worked for me.
Dive into exactly why. It just sometimes it's just a feeling.
Yeah. It's just a feeling.
Like,
you know?
The feeling it gives you. I like the music,
the little twinkle in your eye, the little the butterflies
really
in your
makes
stomach.
You feel like you're in a noir.
Yeah.
I not a whole lot didn't work for me. I gave it 4 stars, but I could definitely see this movie being one that like goes up to a 4.5. My initial ratings are so weird.
Yeah.
Sometimes you like overreact too positively, and sometimes you're like guarding yourself. So we'll see. Because I really, truly think this is a movie that I'll in 6 months I'll be like, man, I'm kind of intrigued. Like I almost want to revisit this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's so I love movies that are like cool, you know. And this definitely has that vibe that of a guy who's just like cool to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it influenced a lot of movies. Well, there was a movie that I hadn't thought of that on the Wikipedia noted that it referenced that it was influenced by or in the Samurai influenced it, and that's Drive.
Oh.
That makes a ton of sense. Hitman doesn't talk a lot. The thing that Drive hits on more is that relationship aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But in a lot of ways, I'm like, Drive is like a modern version of the Samurai.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely differences, but there's a lot of similarities too.
Alain Delon and Ryan Gosling are both very attractive younger males.
Exactly.
So maybe.
Yeah. So.
Which we've also reviewed. So go be sure.
Yeah,
to
go listen to the Drive episode. I think if I was being completely honest, I think this movie is much better than Drive. I don't know whether like I would like Drive has a lot of like personal weight to it because of when I watched it and. Well, I shouldn't say personal weight, but it
we
just,
also have a friend who really looks like Ryan Gosling.
Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
I have a lot of nostalgia for the movie Drive. Is maybe the more and it,
he showed up to the movie vault with the Drive jacket on with the scorpion on the back.
It was awesome.
That was memorable.
Yeah, and I think it was one of the movies I watched earlier. The movies that I watched when I was really starting to get into watching movies have definitely stuck with me. So maybe they'll have a little bit more nostalgia than like Le Samurai would have, but.
Yeah.
But this movie is just really well crafted. Roger Ebert raves about it, has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, highly regarded movie. And of course, in hindsight, a lot of these older movies get great reviews because everyone's scared to have a bad take on it.
Well, I gave it 4 stars as well. I could see it going up. I don't see it going down.
Yeah, I really don't see that. This is definitely not a 3.5-star
now
movie.
That these thoughts are coming out. It was directed by Jean-Pierre Melville, who was in a film called Breathless. Did you know that?
He was in it.
He played the character Parvulesco in Breathless.
I do not remember which character that
was. Who is the ninth main character.
The ninth main character.
Yes.
I do love Breathless. That's one of my favorite movies.
That's why
I
brought it up. And that was directed by Jean-Luc Godard.
Yeah. And this is actually one of his later movies. And it's funny because it's probably his most famous.
You're talking about Melville?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other one I've heard of kind of a lot more of his Un Flick, which is his last movie. I think I have that on my
watch list. Is that his Inland Empire of his career?
Could be. I have it on my watch list on Canopy, so maybe I'll get to it one of these days. Mm. But it looks like he made around, I don't know, 10 to 15 films.
Yeah. 14.
14 films. Nice. Although this is him as a director and a writer, so I think he directed all these movies. Yeah, so basically it's like they list like all the movies that have like lone wolf protagonists and their hitmen, like John Wick. Mm. They have been influenced by this movie, but I think Melville, or however you pronounce his last name, he worked mainly in noir. So he's not considered in like the main group of French New Wave directors, but mm-hmm. he's like in that like second circle. That's like, they were definitely took aspects of it, but he's more of a genre filmmaker than some of the other, cause he kind of stayed a lot in the noir and neo-noir zone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that not every single one of his movies was there. Apparently Roger Ebert called him one of the greatest directors ever.
Yeah, I mean, he influenced Scorsese, Tarantino. Some people, I mean, they said Jim Jarmusch even was influenced by him.
Yeah, apparently one of his movies was, not one of his more well-known movies, but one about a samurai, I think, that he made, was influenced by this movie. Yeah. Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. Yeah. Oh. Which, like I said, it's not one of his better-known movies, but still.
It's Jim Jarmusch, one of our favorites here at the Movie Vault. Yeah, if you have big white fluffy hair like that, then you're a genius. Lynch and Jarmusch.
Yeah. And these people from these French directors, they just know how to show cool movies and cool people. Mm-hmm. And they make smoking look cool.
I've always said that. I've always said French films make me feel like I want to smoke cigarettes.
And you know, being in even in London, people who smoke, it's a different class of people than the people who smoke cigarettes in the U.S. And this is, it's going to sound bad in some ways, but the stereotype of the person who smokes cigarettes in the U.S., because we actually do have a pretty good, if you're going to say propaganda is good, our anti-cigarette propaganda is pretty good in the U.S. But unfortunately, lower classes tend to, which it's really unfortunate because they target lower classes too with selling, like, poor, you know, people who have less income with cigarettes, and then they tax them a bunch because it's like a sin tax because you shouldn't be doing it. So it really doesn't hurt the people who are wealthy, the tax. It hurts the poor people, and then they're dependent on cigarettes and they don't really have a lot of resources to get off of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely not a pure thing, the anti-smoking propaganda, but a lot of people in the U.S. are turned away from smoking because of it. So I guess you have to take the good with the bad.
Mm-hmm.
But we picture a certain type of person. You know, our colleges have both taught us we have inherent bias. So we have inherent bias. Well, I don't know to what extent they're right, but we do like have stereotypes. And there's a certain class of individual that we stereotype as having smoking cigarettes in the U.S.
Yeah.
Anyway, long backstory to say in London, it was not like that. All classes of people smoke. It's very still very much.
So it's a uniting factor for the country. It's
not taboo to smoke. So it looks cooler because the people who are smoking look like they're more attractive. They look cooler. They're more put together in some regards, at least externally.
Yeah.
So and that comes out in these movies where they have the people taking the drags with cigarette and you know, you and I both smoke cigars, and it looks cool when you smoke a cigar, so, you know, it makes sense. It's just unfortunate that it's really bad for you, and it's very addicting. Like, maybe if you were able to, like, kind of smoke a cigarette every once in a while, it wouldn't be that bad for you, but the fact of the matter is the nicotine is very easy to get dependent on, and it's easy to get to the point where you're smoking 12 cigarettes a day.
Yeah.
and that is very bad for you.
Yeah. Although thanks a lot for that history, nurse.
A lot of people in England, I guess, are doing just fine with their great free health care system and stuff. You know,
well, you say that cigarettes. With levity, but...
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I don't know what they're doing fine, but...
Oh, the Brits.
Anyway, that was a long tangent to talk about the differences in culture and smoking.
Yeah. Well, anything else to add to this film, Ben?
Not a whole lot.
Just this is another one of those simple
go
ones.
Go watch it.
Like a Buster Keaton type of film.
Yeah. And this is a movie where I'm like, I'm really sad when people are just so turned off to watching any movie that you have to follow with subtitles. Because I think this is a like really cool and interesting movie that a lot of people would like.
It was also fun that we got to watch it on a big screen.
We did. The environment we watched it in made it better, probably. Yeah. If we watched all our movies on that, we'd probably like every movie like a half star more.
Maybe so.
There's some movies that we still wouldn't like that much, but
Inland Empire on that screen.
Oh, it would be awesome. But yeah. Every time I end up watching a lot of times I will end up watching part of movies on my phone because at the end of the day I have to finish watching the movie, and however I can do that, I'll do. But my most egregious is watching Interstellar on my phone. That, you know, I
the
probably
surround
have,
sound.
Have a lot higher thoughts about Interstellar, and I love it, and I still love it if I watch it on a big screen, because it would just make it, this is how it's designed to be viewed.
That I've watched on my phone was Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah,
because I watched it on the way to record for it. That was the only, that was like the closest I've ever cut.
Yeah,
watching a film. Now I spend about 10 hours per film researching.
When I have all this time once I graduate, I won't ever have to think about.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, for a long time, I never, like, it's nice having a TV now. Like, I never really had it. Like, I wouldn't just watch movies in my living room.
Yeah.
And at my family's house. So I had to usually watch them on my laptop. So it'd be nice.
You can't watch Mulholland Drive with your mom.
Yeah, no. Not doing that.
Yeah. I would say get yourself a nice movie theater basement.
One day, maybe.
That's all I got to say.
One day.
Yeah.
Movie vault. Movie theater, basement, studio.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a little ambitious, but I don't know. If you're like, I want to be a hospitable person, having a movie theater basement's not the worst thing.
No. Come over on Friday nights. Let's watch.
Yeah.
Be a good time.
Yeah. Just don't stay closed off. Make sure you're letting other people utilize it, and it might be a good investment.
Yeah. Or if you just use it yourself, might also
That's true.
Be a good
Bring
investment.
Your family close together.
Yeah. You and your bird. Yeah.
All right.
We just recorded an episode.
We can't do movie highlights this week. So hopefully we'll.
Could we remember what we did when this comes out? Should we do the ones before? Like, we just watched Sunset Boulevard.
No.
I'm just joking.
So we'll just do movie highlights next time. Or you'll hear it on the next episode, which will be a very exciting episode, The Fifth Element with Ian Anderson.
That one, yeah, we just recorded that this morning. It was good.
Yeah. We got some exciting stuff, potential stuff coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I won't announce it because I've been burned doing that in the past.
A new series arc starting in the next episode.
Yeah, and then you can take a guess based. I mean, it's a sci-fi arc. It's not real complicated.
Yeah,
The Fifth Element's a sci-fi movie, so we're just like, we'll just continue on.
Yep.
For a couple movies, and then what's next after that?
After that arc, or after
after the sci-fi arc?
We're gonna do a Paul Newman arc.
So. Just so you can prep, watch some sci-fi movies, watch some Paul Newman movies.
Get your research
in the zone. Get your research in. You can be like, man, these guys should have done way more research beforehand. I know so much more about this movie.
Then you can email us and write us.
Email us.
Before.
Yep.
Page us.
themovievaultpod@gmail.com. You could record a voice memo and send it to us, and we'll put it in the episode.
Hey, Zach and Ben. Beep.
Beep you.
Yeah. we'll still put it in, I promise you.
Uncensored. Yeah. I'll put it in do that.
Yeah, we'll censor one letter in it.
All right.
You'll just hear the we'll censor the beginning.
You'll
of
know
the
exactly what they said, but yeah. It'll be a little bit censored.
Yep.
All righty. Shall we close the vault?
You shall.
All right. Do 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 do.